reaction to the whole, the audience as a whole. Now, more on the interrelationship between the Grey Wolves, again, that's the youth wing of the neo-Nazi and pan-Turkist National Action Party, an organization with close ties to the United States, and those ties developed directly out of its ties to Nazi Germany. Again, Radio Free America shows 14 and 21 go into that. Research credit and translation credit for the following also goes to Dave, our Italian translator. From the Corriere della Sera of June 18th of 1987, more concerning the development of the Lebanese connections. And the other course of inquiry, the one that leads to the wholesale exporters of Istanbul and Ankara, bears out the theory of the Rome judges. Ilario Martella, M-A-R-T-E-L-L-A, his colleague Luigi Gennaro, G-E-N-N-A-R-O, and public prosecutor Antonio Marino, M-A-R-I-N-O, reached them during the third probe into the May 1981 attack on the Pope. They discovered that the Grey Wolves of Mehmet Sener, S-E-N-E-R, and Abdullah Katli, C-A-T-L-I, the Turkish refugee group from Switzerland who'd guaranteed Mehmet Ali Ajar protection and economic aid, were the local managers of the heroin and cocaine traffic directed in their country by the heads of the Turkish mafia, quote-unquote. The head of the Swiss cell was actually Oral Çelik, C-E-L-I-K, the elusive Attila, quote-unquote, whom Ajah had placed at the scene of the attack in St. Peter's Square. Remember the name Attila, we're coming back to that in a second. Acquitted of that charge, Çelik now risks being newly sought after by Interpol. Çelik's trail, then, takes the investigators back to an already known direction, Bulgaria. According to a Penitito, Turkish dealer Paul Waridel, W-A-R-I-D-E-L, who's been around Switzerland a long time and who now lives in Athens, at present, Çelik is actually in Sofia, where he works on behalf of an organization engaged in the drug traffic. Between 1981 and 1983, it was Çelik, under the false name Musalulu, who, from his Zurich office, coordinated the deliveries and payments of hundreds of kilos of heroin handled by the Sicilian mafia cells of Michele Greco and Nito Santapaola, S-A-N-T-A-P-A-O-L-A. A report has informed Judge Martella that DEA agents are preoccupied with the activities of that Musalulu man, quote-unquote. So again, Musalulu, alias for Oral Çelik, Musalulu also, a fellow heavily involved with the Shikarchi situation. That Attila alias that you heard, by the way, is another of the aliases of Avni Yasar Musalulu, a.k.a. Oral Çelik. Research credit on the following also goes to Dave, our Italian translator. This is from the book. There are two current books, by the way, on the Pizza Connection case. One of them is called The Last Days of the Sicilians by Ralph Blumenthal. Hardcover edition, New York Times Books, copyright 1988. There's also a current book by Shana Alexander, the name of which I forget. At any rate, from Ralph Blumenthal's The Last Days of the Sicilians, again, New York Times Books, 1988, the following information about another alias of Avni Yasar Musalulu is presented. Reading. Yasar Musalulu was a mysterious Turkish shipowner who procured morphine base for Sicilian heroin producers, who then sold their product to traffickers, who in turn sold to the Badlamentes, the Catalanos, and the Ganchis. Swarthy and powerfully built, with a curved nose and mustache, Musalulu, who also went by the names of Avni Karadurmus and Attila Oskuz, was quickly estimated to have provided up to 7,000 kilos, or nearly 8 tons, of the sticky opium distillate that the mafia's chemists cooked into heroin, a quantity that by itself would have fed almost the entire American heroin habit for a year. So that alias of Musalulu's, again, the one referred to there, Attila Oskuz. That was the reference that you heard in that article from the Corriere that I just read you. So again, the relationship between Shikarchi and the CIA was developed as, was outlined as follows in the Newsweek article. CIA front company purchasing $25 million in foreign currency from Shikarchi between 81 and 88. Shikarchi obviously inextricably linked with Avni Yasar Musalulu, alias Oral Çelik, a fellow who not only touches on the Pope shooting, also the Kunsa heroin operation, in both of those contexts apparently intersecting with the world of Theodore Shackley, a current defendant, or one of the people named in the Danny Sheehan affidavit. Bear in mind also The name of Bekir Çelenk, the reputed paymaster of the plot against the Pope, one of the main people involved with the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring. We're now going to hear another familiar name cropping up in connection with the Shikarchi case, that in turn obviously linking with Stibom International, the Pizza Connection case, and a lot of other things through there. Research credit on the following also goes to Dave, our Italian translator. This is from L'Europeo magazine of February 17th of 1989. And the article reads in part, Shikarchi, the gold trading company whose vice president was Hans Kopp, the husband of the justice minister, was in contact with Richard Secord, one of the chief figures of Irangate. And the Lebanese connection, quote-unquote, was trading gold against drugs by way of Bulgaria, making use of the organization of Bekir Çelenk, whose name was often spoken at the time of the investigation into the attack on the Pope. So here again we have Richard Secord and Bekir Çelenk as being mentioned in the same breath as Shikarchi here. And indeed, the Lebanese connection, which I outlined above, is being described as an extension of the organization of Bekir Çelenk. Bear in mind here, too, that the Iran-Contra scandal, as we looked at in Radio Free America, shows 20, 25, 32, and 34 inextricably linked with Stibom. The Stibom Arms for Drugs trading ring, a major link in the Contra supply effort, also a major source of arms for Iran in its war with Iraq. And again, the references that I made above will outline that for you. We haven't got time to go into it here. Skipping down in the article, and again, Europeo, February 17th, 1989, the Lebdo, that's L'Hebdo, that you hear referred to here, is a very prestigious Lausanne, Switzerland news weekly that's done a lot of investigating into the Lebanese connection. Skipping down here in the article, according to Lebdo's reporters, the present center of attention must be a new personage, Rudolf Gerber, G-E-R-B-E-R, the public prosecutor of Switzerland for 15 years. They say it's his fault if the organizations of drug pushers are able to operate for years practically with impunity. Gerber is a very powerful man. He controls the police and actually claims that he has the police records of a million Swiss. Quote, he's very powerful and very unknown, assures La Save. That's a Swiss journalist, Yves La Save, who works with Lebdo. Quote, he's very powerful and very unknown, unquote, assures La Save. That's L-A-S-S-E-V-E-R. Quote, most Swiss don't know who he is either. He never gives interviews. We always have to publish the same photo because we don't have any others of him. Now, regarding Gerber, there are two events that leave me dumbfounded. In 1976, his girlfriend, a woman from high society, was assassinated in Zumikon, Z-U-M-I-K-O-N, the small town on the lake of Zurich, which then housed the Kopp cartel. A girlfriend of the woman promised revelations but was arrested, spent 3 months in prison, and when set free, revealed nothing. However, it was uncovered that hardly had she been summoned by the police than she'd telephoned at midnight the Bern home of Gerber, who was already prosecutor, to speak insistently to him about the murder victim's diary. In 1979, the Zurich magistracy suspended the investigations. Quote, and here we come to the second event, continues La Save, pulling out a box of photocopies. Quoting again, this reached us confidentially. It's an arrest warrant against Yasser Musalulu, the great drug trafficker who lived in Zurich. Look, this is his picture. Beside it, there's written, dangerous individual, unquote. And look here, on the bottom part of the picture, a note, don't arrest him. Inform the federal prosecutor's office, unquote. This explains why Musalulu was able to quietly leave Swiss territory a year later. So obviously there's a fairly significant connection between Rudolf Gerber and Avni Yasser Musalulu, one of the central figures in the case, in the investigation into the shooting of Pope John Paul II, the European distributor for Kunsa's heroin, described both by the Christic Institute's Sheehan affidavit and by Bo Greitz as being a fellow who was involved, Kunsa being heavily involved with Theodore Shackley as well, the same Theodore Shackley who went to Italy a couple of months before the Pope was shot to work with Giuseppe Santavito of the P2, also heavily involved with Stibom. And again, bear in mind that Richard Secord, another member of what the Christic Institute refers to as the secret team, his name has now cropped up in connection with Shikarchi AG. It's interesting, too, to take a look at the synchronization of movements and of developments. This past week, obviously, there were a number of developments in the trial of Oliver North. We're going to talk briefly on the North trial and a couple of names that have cropped up in connection with it. It's interesting to take a look at some of the coordination, if indeed that's what it is, some of the coincidental occurrences with regard to both Shikarchi and the Iran-Contra scandal. On page A14 of the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, March 7th of 1989, there's an interesting juxtaposition of articles. Most of the page is taken up with a large article, which we're going to touch on in a second. Witness tells of North's promise. It's an LA Times story, Dateline Washington, subheaded, President Will Shake Your Hand. That takes up most of the page. Way over in the opposite column, the right-hand column, there are just a couple of sentences here. A very small article, what I call a postage stamp article, right next to the article about Oliver North and company. Scandal does in Swiss prosecutor. Reuters story, Dateline Zurich. Switzerland's public prosecutor, Rudolf Gerber, was suspended in a major drugs and money laundering scandal that ended the career of the country's first female government minister, Elisabeth Kopp. Justice Minister Arnold Kohler told a news conference in Bern yesterday that Gerber will be suspended pending disciplinary procedures. So his suspension, just as the Oliver North trial, I should say, is gathering speed, is an interesting intersection of events here. And I think the significance of having these two things at the same time could not be overestimated or could not be exaggerated. It's really interesting to see these two articles on the same page, both obviously strongly connected, and yet to look at this page, you'd have no idea that it was necessarily any connection whatsoever. This great big article, Witness Tells of North's Promise, just beside it, one column over, little tiny column you wouldn't know was connected with it in any way. But suffice it to say, that fellow Rudolf Gerber, the Swiss public prosecutor, was the fellow who quite apparently was helping to protect Aral Chalik, a.k.a. Avni Yasser Musalulu, of the Pizza Connection case, the Pope shooting case, and quite possibly, certainly in some ways, a people who appears to have had dealings with elements of what the Christic Institute has termed the secret team. Another fascinating development, too. Here it is. Okay, I thought for a second I'd misplaced my article. Another interesting development with regard to this case, too, possible development with regard to this case, came out in the papers this past week. Reading now from the New York Times of Wednesday, March 8th of 1989, there's a story about a money laundering case related to drug smuggling. However, for the life of me, I can't tell you whether or not this connects up with the Shikarchi AG case. Now, the Newsweek article that we looked at to begin the broadcast referred to this inquiry as taking place in New York. I suspect that the following article refers to the Shikarchi AG case, but it is so vague and so strikingly lacking in particulars that we really can't tell. I'm going to read the story, and I wonder whether some of the CIA connections to the case, some of the profound political implications of the things, the various shores upon which the Shikarchi waters lap, may very well have something to do with the apparent lack of candor in this particular write-up. It's interesting that the judge in this case, Judge John E. Sprizzo, S-P-R-I-Z-Z-O, is very critical of the prosecutors in the case and the investigators, claiming that basically their prosecution and their investigation was so shoddy that he would have to turn the drug dealers loose. Now, what frequently happens in connection with an intelligence-related court case is that one sees a weak prosecution. If, say, an assassin or a drug smuggler with connections to the national security establishment gets picked up, and if the authorities want him to be released, very frequently he will stand trial, but there will be a weak prosecution, a deliberately blown prosecution. That may be what the judge is so upset about here, but again, we really can't tell past a point whether this particular article refers to the Shikarchi case. I suspect it does, or whether it refers to something altogether different. The article, to me, is striking for its lack of particulars. I challenge any listener as I read this story to tell me precisely what this is about. It's a remarkably vague article. There are no particulars in the entire story. Again, this is from the New York Times, Wednesday, March 8th of 1989. It appears on page A17 of the Western Edition. It's a story by William Glaberson, or Glaberson, G-L-A-B-E-R-S-O-N, of the New York Times. Dateline New York, March 7th. It's headlined, Judge Unseals Sharp Criticism of Prosecutors, says publicity may lead to drug case mistrial. Be very interesting if we have a mistrial here, because obviously, if this is the Shikarchi case, an awful lot of people stand to get burned if this comes out. Chiefly, the U.S. National Security Establishment. A federal judge today unsealed the transcript of a court proceeding Monday in which he assailed prosecutors as incompetent and inept and blamed them for forcing him to set drug dealers free. But the judge, John E. Spritzo, said a storm of publicity about his remarks might have so prejudiced the jury in the drug conspiracy case that he might have to declare a mistrial. If anything, he said, the cat is out of the bag in very large doses, unquote. On Monday, Judge Spritzo belittled the efforts of federal prosecutors and dismissed 7 of 14 defendants in a drug case that the government has said involved a heroin and cocaine trafficking conspiracy tied to a Sicilian mob. The 54-year-old judge spoke from the bench today at a hearing called so the lawyers in the case could discuss the impact of the publicity on jurors. A lawyer for the New York Times, George Freeman, also appeared at the hearing to contest the judge's orders sealing all proceedings involving legal issues and prohibiting all the lawyers from publicly discussing the case. Judge Spritzo said he would unseal the record of Monday's remarks, but he denied all of the Times' other requests. The judge's outspoken criticism of the prosecutors and the press has changed the focus of a trial that until today had received little attention outside of the courthouse. But people who know the round-faced, gravelly-voiced judge well say they are not surprised. The judge, who through the 4 months of the trial had become increasingly irritated with the prosecuting lawyers, then sought to seal the transcript of the hearing. The three assistant United States attorneys who have been trying the drug case before Judge Spritzo had a healthy taste of what friends describe as his strong personality. He frequently showed his impatience with their case, telling them they had never proved that drug dealings by the defendants were connected to the larger conspiracy that the government had promised in its charges. He told the prosecutors that the United States attorney should run a training school, quote-unquote, to teach them how to try cases, and he threatened them with contempt of court. If they did not get his rather pointed message, Judge Spritzo underscored it for them with the bluntness that has become familiar around the courthouse. In the midst of one legal argument, he said to a prosecutor, quote, whether you are just dense, I don't understand it. With all the things I told you since the trial commenced and all the unflattering comments I made to you three collectively, you still don't seem to be learning anything, unquote. And I would add that we don't seem to be learning anything about that case either. The secrecy surrounding the case, the remarkable actions by the judge and the prosecutors, all raise a lot of questions in my mind. And again, I've read that article several times. There are no indications whether or not this is the Shikarchi case, whether it's in relation to Pizza Connection 4, whether it's in any relation to the other three Pizza Connection cases, at least one of which involved cocaine smuggling by the Medellin cartel. That's another of the elements cited in the Sheehan affidavit as being a part of the Contra support effort. Whether or not that's the Shikarchi case that Judge Spritzo is talking about and hearing, anybody's guess, because there is a remarkable lack of particulars in that particular story. At any rate, that concludes our discussion of the Shikarchi case. We're going to take a musical break, and then I'm going to come back with some more articles, and we should have plenty of time for phone calls this evening. We're going to continue now with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. And in a sense, we're still going to be taking a look at elements, intersecting elements with the connection we just took a look at. And again, for the information just presented, hats off to Dave, our Italian translator, who's been doing great work at no small risk to himself. And that is a major, major connection. In the archive broadcast called The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror, and The Exoneration of the Secret Team, the development of Pizza Connection 4 and the resignation of former federal prosecutor Rudolph Giuliani in New York was discussed at considerable length. I think now we're perhaps in a position to see just why Rudolph Giuliani was going to resign as some of these key cases were breaking in December and January. A lot of irons in the fire and a lot of fingers stand to get burned if some of this unravels to the extent that it might. One of the most outstanding contributions that was made during the career of the late Mae Brussel, whose work was aired here for many years and will be again at some point when I can work that out, was Mae's pointing out of the strategic use of terrorism and specifically provocation by the U.S. national security establishment, beginning with her landmark work concerning the Symbionese Liberation Army and her investigation of that institution, that organization, as a CIA front, which is what it was. The SLA was not a legitimate organization at all. Well, not legitimate, that's the wrong word. It was not what it represented itself as being. It was, in fact, a U.S. intelligence operation specifically put together as an act of political provocation to not only discredit anti-war forces and progressive forces, but also specifically to serve as a pretext for cracking down on the more progressive political elements in this country. The use of provocation or the setting up of a terrorist incident in order to justify one's own actions is, as Mae has pointed out, one of the major tools in the arsenal of the U.S. national security establishment. If progressive forces in this country are ever going to come to terms with what is going on in a practical way, they are going to have to confront the tragic legacy of Mae's work. Unfortunately, her work did not receive the attention it should have, and until or unless it does, and until or unless people begin taking a look at the use of provocation, then unfortunately the progressive forces are going no place in this country. From the Symbionese Liberation Army to the Lapenka bombing in 1984, to things that we're going to be looking at this evening, there is no getting away from the monumental and tragic implications of Mae's research. And again, as long as the terrorist milieu continues to be an element of mystery or a source of mystery to the progressive forces, and it would appear that it's pretty much that at this stage of the game, then the battle, as they say, is lost. Because again, this administration in particular, meaning the Reagan-Bush administration and the U.S. national security establishment in general, have long been using terrorism in a strategic way. An echo of that was carried in the article that I touched on earlier. Again, this is on the same page as the information concerning Rudolf Gerber's suspension in connection with the Shikarchi case in Switzerland. On that same page, page A14 of the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, March 7th of 1989, there's an L.A. Times story, Dateline Washington, headlined, "Witness Tells of North's Promise, Subheaded President Will Shake Your Hand." And there's discussion here of the aforementioned Richard Secord, a person whose name has cropped up in connection with the Shikarchi investigation. Skipping down on the article, "North's defense is that his superiors in the Reagan administration approved his activities, but instructed him to conceal them from others, including Congress." On cross-examination of Robert C. Dutton, Brendan Sullivan, North's attorney, elicited testimony that Dutton and two others who had helped North in the Contra Supply mission, retired Air Force officers Richard Secord and Richard B. Gadd, all had taken part in a high-risk, covert mission authorized by President Jimmy Carter 9 years ago. That was the unsuccessful secret mission to Tehran to rescue 52 American hostages in the spring of 1980. The mission had to be given up when Iranians discovered it in its final hours. The hostages were released in January of 1981 after 444 days in captivity. Well, in the information that we presented in Radio Free America number 31, that's the third program in a six-part series about the Iran-Contra scandal, the probability that, in fact, that attempted hostage rescue mission was deliberately sabotaged from within, well, we looked at the probability that that mission was sabotaged from within. In an article by Donald Freed in the Rebel magazine, a now-defunct political publication, Donald Freed, in his Rebel article, made a very strong case that, in fact, a back-channel intelligence operation from the Reagan campaign into the Iranian camp, the Khomeini camp, not only helped to prolong the hostages' captivity, the much-discussed October surprise scenario, but also makes a very good case that, in fact, these veteran intelligencers, connected with, among others, George Bush, deliberately sabotaged the Iranian hostage rescue mission. And with a fellow like Richard Secord, who obviously was not working for Jimmy Carter in 1980, with him playing a key role in the hostage rescue attempt, I think it's not hard to understand why the information developed by people like Donald Freed has come out. Indeed, it's sort of distressing that the obvious implications of having people connected to Ronald Reagan and George Bush running Jimmy Carter's unsuccessful covert operations, well, the implications of that have not been discussed.